not everything makes money, you know, and I think having done it for this period of time now, we've got a fair feel for what's going to make money and what's not going to make money. So if we feel like it's not going to make money for the owner and it's not going to make money for us, it's better if we don't try and manage it. And you know, we try and provide some guidance for people if possible before they make the purchase. You know, we would recommend, okay, we understand that you would like to do this kind of thing, but actually we feel like that would be a better decision. But some people are just capped by budget, you know. So, you know, naturally, there is a certain budget threshold that's required in Kyoto to get a good result.
Hi there, folks, and welcome or welcome back to Nippon Trading International's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima again, and this podcast is brought to you, among others, by Emil Gorgis of realestate.jp. He's a Tokyo real estate agent who specializes in serving international or mixed nationality families who are looking for the perfect family home. So Emil's an Australian. He's been living here in Japan for over two decades now. And for about half of that time, he's been buying, selling, and managing real estate properties in Tokyo on behalf of his own family and a great many happy clients. And he also acts as a mortgage broker on behalf of his clients. So he's got dedicated loan officers in many of the Japanese mega banks. And if you're a regular listener of the podcast, you probably already know him from our JREP, the Japan Real Estate Experts panel sessions, which means that you're already aware of the fact that the man is an absolute fountain of wisdom on all things related to real estate in Japan, and in particular to family homes, the greater Tokyo metropolitan area, and mortgages. And most importantly, he's incredibly generous with his time and advice, which he's more than happy to provide at no cost or commitment to anyone asking. So if you've been thinking about buying your home in Tokyo, but you've been sitting on the fence for a while, or you just want to have a chat in English with a real expert, drop him a line on sales@realestate.jp. Hit him up today and start exploring your options. All right, so for today's episode, continuing the series of interviews that I've done with agents in various locations around Japan, their past and present experience in their local markets, and their views on the industry in general. And this episode's guest probably doesn't need a special introduction if you're a regular listener of the podcast, and definitely if you've been attending any of the Japan Real Estate Summits, in person or online. It's Chai Kanda, founder and CEO of Shiki Properties, based in Kyoto, and he's also our resident panel speaker and presentation giver on the topic of the Kyoto and Kansai areas property markets, as well as high-end hospitality properties and boutique hotels. So we chat about his own personal history and work at Shiki. We get a rundown on Kyoto's short-term stay property market, which is a lot more mature and professional than other similar markets nationwide. We also talk a bit about why the hybrid holiday home slash Airbnb model isn't as frequent or as profitable there anymore. The clients that they serve, the budget that these clients and other investors are targeting, both in Kyoto and Osaka, and what should investors be purchasing? So which property profiles exactly are the ones to look into there? We also talk about how the tourism market is faring there this year and why the current regulatory and licensing landscape, including some recent deal samples. We riff a bit about whether one should buy ready-to-go, renovated properties, or buy them old and renovate them on your own. And of course, how's the current political climate and anti-foreigner sentiment affecting the short-term stay market in his backyard specifically? What it's done to service standards, to recruiting and retaining foreign talent, and the tourist and over-tourism problem as a whole. And finally, about Shiki's expansion into boutique hotels, winter resort hospitality projects, and even residential projects. So really interesting conversation with a real local expert. Have a listen, and I'll see you again on the other side. All right. Well, good to see you again, man. To the few listeners, viewers who've been kind of living under a rock or not attending the Japan Real Estate Summit, where you're now a staple of, quick, brief, personal, professional intro.
Yes, sure. So I'm Chai Kanda. I'm the founder and CEO of Shiki Properties. And so we have a management business as well as a brokerage, and we're headquartered in Kyoto. So we deal with a lot of machiya style properties. We have 50 of those that we manage, as well as three boutique hotels. So both sides of that business are growing. And our brokerage business deals with a lot of those properties. So we talk to investors who are either already purchased those properties or interested in purchasing. And then we help them to find those properties. And then we offer the full range of services, including, you know, introduction to architect and project management of the renovation through to the operation, the linen, the cleaning, the guest communication, and, you know, monthly reporting. And then if they decide to sell one day, we can assist with that as well.
So you leave, eat, drink, breathe hospitality properties, basically.
I'm afraid so. That's quite accurate as well. But yeah, I mean, look, it's a 24/7, 365 business. So, you know, that requires a lot of cost as well to run that sort of business. You know, it's not just a one shift Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. So there's a huge amount of cost and complexity involved with running the business, particularly the operations side of it. It can be a bit of a thankless task, but that's the task we're charged with. So yeah, we've been doing it for 12 years now.
12 years. Okay. How did you get into it? You told me a long, long time ago, but I kind of forget, and there's other people who don't even know how. What's your personal background?
Yeah. So, I mean, personally, I grew up in Sydney, Australia, and I've got a finance degree and a law degree, both of which I'm not really using, I guess. But
well, the finance aspect must come in handy, no?
Definitely.
And the law, actually, come to think of it. Yeah.
Like, to be honest, not too bad choices if you don't know what you want to do. And I had a little bit of a crack in both those industries. But for me, you know, I was always interested in business. And I did have a job in Osaka for 7 years, which was a fantastic way to understand how to work with Japanese people. And in Japan, it was a very, very good paid education, you know, if you look at it that way. Following that, travel was always my passion. And, you know, I was in Osaka and see this Airbnb thing come up, and I thought I'll just, you know, throw my apartment on there while I'm traveling. And then, realized, the trips become free. This is quite interesting. So, yeah, I spent a little bit of time in Kyoto when I first came to Japan. And I remember even at that time walking around and looking at the older properties, which are called machiya there, these traditional Japanese wooden houses, looking at those and thinking, like, you know, there's something here, like, this is really interesting. And I had some very fond memories of my time in Kyoto some 20 years back now. But as I saw Japanese tourism trending higher, I thought, you know, that's gonna keep going, and Kyoto's gonna be a key player in the story. And turns out, for a change, I was right on a few things in hindsight. You know, we've gone from a situation where we're 10 million inbound travelers when I first started the business to 42.7 last year. So
wow,
it's been a wild ride. I'll also mention this, but, you know, when I started it, I had a few people tell me, you're too late. So
Too late. How do you mean oversaturated market?
Too late to the industry. Yeah.
Okay. So,
you know, and we've more than quadrupled. So, you know, that's something I often say when I have the opportunity to speak to an audience, is that, you know, people might tell you, you're too late, and they're probably wrong.
Mm. Are a lot of your clients, the ones who own and run these properties, I mean, not the guests, are a lot of them similar to what you've described, like, you know, having a place and renting it out so it pays for their travel when they're not using it, kind of thing? Or are more of them institutional, kind of running an actual fully pledged business?
Yeah, and interesting you phrase it in that way. So none of them are like how I describe myself initially, actually. I don't think even a single one, which is interesting. So, you know, when I first kicked off, it was basically just trying to get a few extra dollars while I was away. And, you know, I didn't have the proper license. Most people didn't even know there was a license at that point in time.
Didn't even need a license back then,
well,
did you?
Well, I think you maybe did actually, but nobody, I didn't even know that. You're like, no, people, it was the kind of Wild West cowboy era. And then it kind of really blew up over that next few years. And then the government stepped in, and that was the kind of the first wave of regulation, much needed, I think. I believe that there was 1 year in Osaka City where the number of minpaku increased by 50x. I don't know if you remember hearing that, but that's not a very healthy market. So, you know, regulation came in, and, you know, that kind of style of renting it out on occasion while you're traveling, it became less attractive, and the market's really moved on. So it's just becomes much more professional market. So there's not so much of a space for that really amateur rent your room out while you're traveling sort of model these days. That's largely gone, particularly in places like Kyoto, which is a very, you know, mature tourism market. And so most of our owners are they hardly use the property at all. They're very welcome to if they would like, and occasionally some of them do. Most of them, when they contact us, it's already booked, which means we're, you know, doing our job.
Great position to be in, I guess, right?
But yeah, as far as I'm concerned, I mean, it's, you know, it's their house. If they want to use it, they should use it. But yeah, most of them are quite serious investors, and we've actually seen over the years that the investors have become more and more sophisticated.
How do you mean sophisticated? How?
I mean, I think in the early days, you know, there was a lot of domestic investors, and they're just kind of seeing the news flash and jumping on board. Budgets were lower. They weren't really, you know, underwriting the process so much. It was just build it and see what happens. You know, and then over the coming years, we've had, you know, the budgets have gone up, the costs have all gone up, as have the ADRs. The demand of the guest has gone up, the whole quality of the market's gone up. So
ADR, just for the uninitiated, is average daily rate, right?
Correct. Yes, that's correct. So everything's just kind of crept higher, and naturally the level of investment required to create that sort of property has gone higher as well. So you've naturally got a higher level of investor, and because there's more money on the table, because they're, you know, more professional, they're really having a look at the returns that they can generate, the yield, extremely closely in most instances. And, you know, that's something, I think that's something where we have quite an edge, because, you know, we operate 83 properties at the moment, and we've been doing it for 12 years. So we've got a lot of data behind us, and, you know, we can tell with a fair amount of accuracy, we can predict, you know, this property, this location, this kind of renovation budget, we can expect this sort of result.
I think you've also over time positioned yourself to be active in the serious segment of the market. I remember when we first got in touch, must have been 6-7 years ago, I managed to slip one client in there who's got a little, you know, a little cheap room that he's kind of renting out when he's not using, kind of thing. But these days you don't take these customers on anymore, do you?
And I, you know, I might not have taken that property if it wasn't from yourself as well. I was flattered to receive the contact. I mean, not everything makes money, you know, and I think having done it for this period of time now, we've got a fair feel for what's going to make money and what's not going to make money. So if we feel like it's not going to make money for the owner and it's not going to make money for us, it's better if we don't try and manage it. And, you know, we try and provide some guidance for people, if possible, before they make the purchase. You know, we would recommend, okay, we understand that you would like to do this kind of thing, but actually we feel like that would be a better decision. But some people are just capped by budget, you know. So, you know, naturally, there is a certain budget threshold that's required in Kyoto to get a good result.
Now, if you're actively looking at property in Japan, you should check out Akiya Mart. That's AKIYA-Mart, M-A-R-T, akiyamart.com. It's the Zillow of Japan, built for buyers who are actively hunting for a home in Japan and want a much more Western-style web browsing experience than the typical local Japanese websites. Now, we've got an exclusive 30% off promo code for the Akiya Mart Pro annual plan. That's the one that gives you full access to Airbnb zoning maps, hazard maps, sold data, and over 500,000 listings nationwide at any given time. So if you're serious about buying in Japan and you want an easier way to search, this is the best tool that we know of. So you can use my code ZIV, Z-I-V, at checkout and get 30% off your Akiya Mart Pro annual plan at akiyamart.com.
Osaka obviously had a lower budget threshold, but
that's right. Actually, can you speak a little bit about that? Because you do cover beyond Kyoto. I mean, Kyoto is where, you know, like you said, it's a very mature market, but there are areas in the vicinity of Kyoto that you cover as well that are also potentially profitable markets, right?
Yeah, I mean, Osaka had a fantastic year last year, and you know, prices have gone up in Osaka as well substantially, you know. As
very hot market at the moment, where we're competing very hard for properties there when we find one.
Yes, okay, and that's mostly on the residential side.
Residential or commercial, but normally not short term, maybe monthly stays, but not beyond that. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And I mean, probably lucky you're not. I mean, it's Osaka's having a bit of a hard time in the STR market at the moment, and you know the reason is that with the expo last year, there was a massive increase in supply of hotel rooms, massive. And this year, Osaka's getting hurt the most by the drop in the Chinese tourists, which is, I don't know how much we want to go into that, but you know, there was a few poorly selected words by the new prime minister early on in her.
No, we're going to get into the new prime minister. Yeah, definitely. Don't be shy.
yeah. So as a result of that, you know, there was a substantial drop in the amount of Chinese tourists, and Osaka was, you know, one of the biggest markets, or you know, probably the biggest market in terms of percentage of the type of tourist that's no longer coming. So it's left a big gap in the market, and you know,
so oversupplied at the moment is what you mean
for the demand. Yes, that's right. Yeah. And so, you know, a lot of the properties that came in over the last few years were centrally located hotels, and so they're now dropping their rates and being quite attractive. So it's really changed the dynamic in the Osaka
market. That's good to know. So that's where I should be planning my next domestic holiday then.
Perhaps. Yeah. Definitely the rates are low. I mean, I'm staying down there tomorrow night, actually, and I was just checking last night, and you know, it is June, it is a low season anyway, but yeah, rates are low. So you know, rates are down, you know, like 30-40% this year, and then occupancy is also down 30-40%. Yeah. So you multiply those and it's, you know, like half the revenue.
A lot less money going into the city, basically. Yeah.
Yeah, half the revenue. But I mean, last year was a fantastic year. It was absolutely, you know, firing from the hip. So, you know, Osaka has always been much more volatile city in terms of results. And Kyoto's got a lot more stability just from that.
But on the other hand, Yi, one of your senior staffers who gave a fantastic session at the last summit, by the way, kudos to her. Right. She was telling me once, and you can let me know if that's still the case. She was telling me, and this was about 3 years ago, I think, if you're going for a hospitality property, meaning short-term stay, not monthly or hybrid, if you're going for short-term stay hospitality property in Osaka, don't look below 30 million yen, and in Kyoto, don't look below 50 million yen. Is that still the case for something that would be profitable and easy to manage and easy to generate an income?
Yeah. So maybe I'll start with the Kyoto. It's very difficult to find anything below 50, to be honest. That's commercially viable. You'd have to go in the sticks, and it's not really, it's not going to get a good result, you know. Location is still super important, as is the quality of the property. And both those things are, you know, influenced by the price substantially. So yeah, when we're talking 50 all in, including a renovation, like very tough to hit that number. You have to get a bit lucky or go with something smaller. And that's a point that I've talked about in some of my past presentations at the summit, is that the, you know, size does matter quite a bit in terms of your return. So we would highly recommend people go for that 70 square meters plus, you know, 80 is better than 70, 90 is better than 80.
To cater for families and groups rather than solo or couples, right?
Yes, 5, 6, 7. Yeah, because if you have
and that's a supply demand thing as well, because there's just an oversupply of smaller places.
I mean, if you have a two-person property, you're just competing with every hotel room in the whole city. So
right.
As you go up to four people, the competition drops. 5, it drops again. 6, it drops a lot more, you know, because you do have these apartments in town that can cater to 4 or 5. See, 6, it really drops. And then when you get to 8, it massively drops. So, but it is very difficult to find a 8-person property in Kyoto. Kyoto houses, most of them are not so big. So you can differentiate yourself by going for that sort of property.
And management also becomes a lot more efficient when you're managing a property that's generating a higher daily rate, right?
For the management company, absolutely,
yeah. Well, for your expenses as a landlord, the cleaning or what have you, right?
Yeah. I mean, we see that the yield increases with the larger property, so that must be you must get some efficiencies out of that, for sure. Yeah, I should probably go back on that budget a little bit. So right now, you know, we feel like, 70 to 80 million is probably the number you see.
Okay, so it's gotten even higher. Okay.
Yeah, to get something like quality. So if you're going down to the 60s, there's probably a reason that it's in the 60s, like it needs some work or it's a bit small or something. And you know, if that's
for people not familiar with Japan, 60 million yen is about what, 450,000 US at the moment, right?
I'm afraid it's less than that these days.
Is it? Okay.
We're probably talking 380, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, but it says 160 yen to the dollar. So.
Oh, I haven't been following it. Okay.
Yeah.
And Osaka, but in Osaka, you can get in cheaper, you believe?
Mm, so, yep. So, I'll just finish my thought on Kyoto.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so we do have one property at the moment. We've got a couple of properties which we've purchased ourselves because I thought they were super cheap. And location-wise, they're slightly off-center, but still totally within the zone. We've got one that's 29.8 million unrenovated. And we think that would need a, 20 million renovation, 3 million for architect is what we're suggesting. And then that would get it up to this kind of 4-star premium quality that I talk about quite a bit.
So which that would be just about 60 all up, right?
Well, then you need about 4 mil on the furniture to make it really nice. So it starts, you're going to get up, yeah, it's about 60. Yeah, it's going to be 60. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, that's for a brand new stylish property, but you do have to put some time and effort into that. It's not ready. It's not a, turnkey.
But when you say brand new in Kyoto terms, does that mean kind of renovated from the ground up, or does that mean an actual new construction?
So yeah, brand new renovation. Sorry, I should be clear. Okay. The property is a machia. It's about 100 years old. And, the reason you want, the attractiveness of a machia in Kyoto is that the regulations are much lower for a machia, because the city does want to protect these properties. Personally speaking, I like the older properties more anyway. I enjoy the character of the property.
Most guests would too, I assume, right? It's part of the Japan experience for them.
Definitely some guests value it. Perhaps not all, and that's fine. It doesn't have to be for everyone, but certainly some guests enjoy it as I do. And, it makes for interesting cultural experience on top of your stay, and the city wants to protect these buildings, so they drop the regulations for these types of buildings, and that's why it's an attractive investment. And you know, there is some SDR industry is undergoing some regulatory changes. But for me, these Machias are less risky because we know that the government here wants to protect them. And if they, you know, pull the pin on accommodation usage, basically they just don't become viable to maintain anymore because it's quite expensive to renovate them. So I feel like that is still one of the safest investments for, you know, like a retail investor. And yeah, you know, with so I think it's about 70 million, but the example I was giving, you can probably do it for about 60 if you put in the effort and go through the process yourself. If you go and buy that on the market, it's going to be more like 70 to pay a premium to someone who's
Well,
put in.
when you say yourself, this is yourself buying it and renovating and operating it yourself. If it was one of your clients, they'd need to pay the overhead for having you do what you do, right?
No, so the 60 was for the client.
For a client. Okay.
That's right.
Lucky
Yeah. So
client.
I think it's I think like, you know, we've got that one on the books. I think that's a it's a great deal. You can get it 10 million cheaper by, you know, buying it unrenovated. And by doing that, you know, people can add their own flavor into the property, which owners, you know, often like to do. Sometimes they just prefer to hands off, but some people like to make a few additions or have a little input.
Yen Loans are a sponsor of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. They're a non-bank lender offering financing to both residents and non-residents of Japan for purchases of condominiums, as well as equity release cash-out financing against properties that you already own in Japan, whether mortgaged or fully paid off. They cover all of Japan's major metro areas, Greater Tokyo, Osaka, Kyoto, Kobe, Nagoya, Fukuoka, and Sapporo, offering a full nationwide footprint for all of your condo purchase financing needs. No residency, incorporation, or Japanese bank account is required, and the application process is highly streamlined. They have legitimate backers, highly reputable, and I can personally vouch for their founder, Mark Drapkin. Yen Loans welcome your business. Reach out to them at yenloans.com and let them know that you heard about them on the Japan Real Estate Podcast to receive 50,000 yen off your loan application fee.
And
From
then
your
we
perspective as well, sorry for cutting in, I'm afraid of I'm going to lose that thought. From your perspective as well, would you prefer something that's already been renovated and sold as is, or would you prefer to be able to kind of optimize it to what you know works well for the guests? So, like, would you prefer to run the renovation yourself? Not from a financial perspective, I mean from a profit efficiency perspective.
Yeah, I think given the choice, I think it's nice to be have some input in the renovation to make sure, particularly there's enough things like storage or like layout. But if I'm honest, that was more of an issue in the early days in the industry when you had a lot of architects and construction companies who weren't very experienced. They would make these properties that were just not fit for purpose at all, and it would be a nightmare. But these days, you know, I mean, the industry is very mature here, so there's not that many people who are new to the game. So,
They know what they're doing. Okay.
look, most of the properties are quite good, and or you can make a few slight modifications. But I mean, I still think it's a great option to get something unrenovated and put your own kind of you know, thoughts and feelings into the property, and you get the result that you're looking for.
Okay. So that's Kyoto, Osaka.
Yeah, so jumping over to Osaka. So yeah, I think 30 was the number that you'd mentioned, and that's really crept higher. I think it's
Okay.
gone more like a 40 or even a 50 in Osaka. You can get stuff at 20, but it's pretty cheap and nasty.
Right.
You know, so I mean, you get what you pay for to a large extent. So if you're going for 20s, it's going to be, you know, location will be worse, then the property will be worse. And yeah, we've seen some stuff going for up to 60 in Osaka, so it's really matured a lot, you know, and those properties are looking quite similar to the Kyoto properties even. So
Okay.
that's something that wasn't there 10 years ago. But yeah, there's definitely a few flash sales going on right now with the challenges this year. You know, for the brave investor, could take a look at it. But yeah, it's a little bit difficult to predict when we're going to get this rebound in Osaka. You know, we probably need to see the war wind up, and the PM probably needs to go over to China and mend
shake
the
some hands. Yeah, okay.
I heard a rumor that that's in the works, but you never know with these things.
Well, Trump's gone. Maybe she's next. But I mean, let's go there, because you're operating in a slightly different market than some of the other agents that I talk to, in the sense that you do run a brokerage, but you're 90% focused on hospitality properties, right? And we've seen with other agents that we work with that run the gamut. So, you know, people use us, and then we work with these agents for any kind of purpose, whether it's a holiday home or a residential investment or hybrid or short-term stay. We've seen since there was two waves there. First, there was pre-current government, the whole business manager visa revamp thing, which kind of completely cleared the market of everybody who had a little Airbnb in the countryside dream. And then came in the new government with their, I'm hesitating to say, not to say racist, but let's call it strictly anti-foreigner rhetoric, with all kinds of threats that might be coming in with all kinds of restrictions on foreign ownership or extra taxes or whatnot. And what we've seen since November last year, and it's only slightly starting to recover now, is people have been sitting on their hands just being concerned. Is that something that you felt there, aside from the tourists not being there?
Yeah, so...
Or the Chinese tourists, I'd say. Everybody else is still coming.
Yeah. So I'll address the impact to the business first before anything else. But to be honest, like, we've been busier than ever. So in terms of, yeah, like, and, you know, most of our clients are, like I was saying, on the more sophisticated end. They're serious investors. There's been no drop in demand there. Most of our clients don't live in Japan either. So, you know, still there's no issue investing in Japan. To be honest, I don't think there's going to be any big change there. They would be very silly to do so.
They've done dumber things.
Well, that's right. Yeah, I wouldn't.
Don't put it past them.
No. And certainly they are doing some silly things right now, as far as I'm concerned with the visas. But these things, you know, swing back and forwards a little bit.
Yeah.
But yeah, we've seen more demand than ever, not just from that kind of STR, more sophisticated buyer, but we've been doing more and more kind of institutional grade properties, hotels, developments. We're getting more interest there, and from all different countries. So for me, it's continuing to increase in the hospitality investment space. There's more eyeballs, there's more cash flow coming in from overseas.
Okay, so that's from the business perspective.
Yeah, and then personally speaking, I mean, the changes to the immigration policy and everything, I think they're totally over the top. I'm quite upset about it, to be honest, as a mixed race, internationally minded person and business owner who employs a lot of foreign born staff. We have maybe 60 to 70% of our staff's foreign born. Everybody speaks Japanese. Everybody wants to live here. You know, we rely on those people to operate our business, and it's definitely become difficult for people in that category now with the visas. We're having trouble. Even today, this topic was coming up, and I think it's to the detriment of Japan. You know, Japan is crying out for more labor. There's labor shortages all over the place. You need people to actually do these jobs. They need to realize that.
Now, tell me about it. Fukuoka, finding bilingual staff is like finding a unicorn. It's been hard enough as is. But don't you feel there's a bit of a distance there, in the sense that, like, I don't know, these days I get a cold shoulder everywhere I go, because, again, the anti-foreigner rhetoric has brought a lot of closet racists out into the open that I haven't been feeling that way earlier. But in Kyoto specifically, I was getting the cold shoulder for a good few years now, right? So I'm feeling in Kyoto there's like this gap between what the business owners want and what the locals who don't actually run a business want, right?
Yeah, I mean, first up, I have noticed a change in sentiment. Japan was such a strong history in hospitality, you know, it's some of the best in the world. I've seen those standards slipping now, you know, and
when foreigners are concerned, definitely.
That's right. That's correct. Yes, that's correct. And tourists, you know, and it's like, it's very upsetting to see that. Like, why is your service changed? You know, other countries would be thrilled at getting this additional business. And it's not, it's a generalization. It's certainly not everyone. There's definitely operators in Kyoto, many operators who are loving it, you know, and they're totally equipped to handle the tourist, you know, customers.
Oh, yeah. My personal social and personal business circles have not changed at all, but I'm talking about the average person on the street kind of level or small business owner, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think the news flow has been negative, and it's got into people's minds a little bit. And it's, you know, I would say a bit. I don't think it's like radical or anything, but definitely, you know, the vibe has dropped a little bit. And I think it's you know, I would actually blame the current government for adding to that. I think they've added to that instead of fixing that, and hopefully it swings back the other way, because, you know, tourism is the second most important industry in Japan now, I think that it's going to go to number one. So, you know, they should be doing what they can to protect and grow the industry and nurture it. You know, people are bringing their hard-earned savings to Japan, looking forward to having a great time, and the Japanese should be making sure they have a fantastic time and, you know, getting their money's worth. And I think they've lost the focus a little bit for whatever reason, with the mixed messages going in the news or whatever. And I hope they can recover from that, because, you know, if you don't treat people well, they're not going to come back.
Yeah, I think, well, I mean, it's obviously, there's a lot of layers there. I feel personally the government is leveraging that anti-foreigner fear to garner votes and to, you know, get elected and re-elected. But to be fair, the tourists are not entirely innocent as well, right? There's been some, for lack of a better word, shitheads coming here on a regular basis for quite some time now, right?
Yes, and certainly some from a certain country that you and me have spent quite a lot of time in, unfortunately. So, absolutely. You know, there is a reason why the sentiment has...
Especially Kyoto, yeah.
Yeah. And then a lot of the poor behaviors now on show with social media, you know, they're recording it and putting it online. So,
but they're doing it for social media. Yeah. That's the whole point, right?
Exactly. Which is a new thing, right? Isn't it? So, you know, it's that stuff wasn't happening 10, 15 years ago. And so absolutely it's not completely unjustified. Let's hope we get a little bit of better behavior on both sides. I think it can be easy to overstate the amount, the attitude of the Japanese has changed. I think it's still just a little bit. I don't really have any major issues. I think people should not be discouraged from coming to Japan. I've got a friend staying with us at the moment, and we just did a trip all around the countryside, and the attitude was fantastic for the most part.
No, so. I agree. And Japan is also starting from a place of being completely ultra polite. So even the slight, you know, side eye on the street is very noticeable when it comes from a place that was completely lacking in that. It's more a case of, from my perspective, it was easy for me, even in Kyoto, to just, you know, blurt out a few words in Japanese to differentiate myself from the tourist throngs kind of thing, you know, like, hey, I actually live here, don't lump me in with that. It's getting a bit harder just to get the chance to show that you're not one of those. It's like you're kind of lumped in with them before you even open your mouth. But yeah, like you said, it's a pendulum. I hope it swings the other way.
I hope so. And, you know, I think you described it well. You know, maybe Japan was 10 out of 10 in politeness and it's gone to 8.5.
Yeah.
And the global average is 4. So it's still like...
That's true.
It's still pretty good. And so I think, you know, people shouldn't get carried away with that. But, like, I hope we can get it back up towards 10. And, you know, I'm certainly very happy to speak publicly about this and call it out. You know, I don't know how many people are doing so on the Japanese side, but, you know, maybe people need a little bit of a wake-up call.
Yeah.
We interrupt this broadcast to tell you about Tokyo Family Stays. They're a short-term rentals company in Tokyo, and they offer a home away from home experience, which is just perfect for remote working, quarantining, if that's still a thing, or if you just need somewhere quiet to get away from the world. They offer a variety of options for families, corporate relocations, or even if you're simply transitioning between homes in Tokyo. The properties are super comfortable, tastefully furnished, fully equipped with all amenities, and they accommodate up to 10 people. So really the only thing you'll need to bring with you is your toothbrush and maybe a change of clothes. They come with fast, unlimited wireless internet, dedicated workspaces, and fully equipped kitchens. And they're just a delight to stay in. Fantastic alternative to Japanese business hotels, which if you've ever stayed in one, you probably know. They're tiny, they're noisy, fine for a night or two if you're on your own. But longer term or with a family, you'll probably feel you're in a jail cell very quickly in a Japanese business hotel. So if you want to give yourself a sense of space and freedom by renting a real home, with comfortable Western beds, including all the necessities like baby bedding, children's toys, high chairs, etc., you definitely want to reach out to Tokyo Family Stays. They've been at it for over a decade. They're a fully licensed minpaku or short-term stay operator. And as a special bonus for our viewers and listeners, they're also throwing in a breakfast basket upon arrival for anyone who books and mentions the Japan Real Estate Podcast or NTI. And not only for guests, if you're a property owner, you've got an investment property that you want to tweak for higher profit, or a holiday home that you want to rent out when you're not using it via short-term stays, drop them a line today. See how they can help you maximize your property's income. And again, as a special bonus to our viewers and listeners, they're also offering a free audit of your existing short-term stay listings without any obligation whatsoever. So feel free to reach out to them at tokyofamilystays.com. Well worth a visit. And again, if you're in the market for a family home in or around the Tokyo metropolitan area, Emil's your man. Don't be shy to reach out to him as well at sales@realestate.jp. And now back to the podcast.
Yeah. So what are you, so you've recently, just to wrap things up, you've recently expanded or at least expanded more into boutique hotels, right? You've mentioned that at our last event in April. Is that a shift that you're looking to completely phase off these more traditional type minpaku properties, or is that something that you're adding to your portfolio? Because I know you've also started operating down in Nagano as well, right?
Yeah. So it's a couple of, I'll break that up a little bit. So the boutique hotels is adding, you know, so our core business is still STRs, you know, it's still, we still spend a lot of time on that. But we've taken on management of more boutique hotels, and you know they do have their added benefits in terms of operation, and so naturally we've gone into brokerage of those as well. But the two don't always fall together, and that's totally fine as well. We're fine to just broker it, and you know often those institutional buyers maybe want to operate themselves, or they have a, you know, some other arrangement, which is completely fine. Same for the STRs. That's part of the business that we're seeing.
Some of them come with an operator already in place too, don't they?
Almost always change with the hotels.
Okay.
Yeah. Usually people are selling because they're not getting the results they want. And one of the reasons they're not is because of the operator. So it's just
less than ideal management. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and a lot of these hotels, I mean, most of the clients are looking to value add. So, you know, maybe they're a little bit older and then they need a, you know, renovation and a repositioning. And then whilst going through that process, you change the operator. It's a pretty standard kind of strategy and it can work very well.
Right. And Nagano?
Yeah, so we opened an office there about a year back, and we have a manager there, Ben, who was also at the summit. And
yeah,
and I gave him a slot there, and it seemed very popular. I could see the very genuine interest, and you know, I'm very much considering how we can get him a little bit more game time next time, because I think people want to hear about that topic clearly. So. Yeah, we opened the Nagano office. We're basically looking to provide the same services as Kyoto, which is the brokerage and also the management. So we've done a bit of both. And for the upcoming winter season, we have quite a few new properties we're onboarding. It's a totally...
Similar kind of properties? I mean, STR and hotels or more of either?
Yeah, both. So okay. We've got we had one STR open up last year, and we're already taking some very nice bookings for this year. Ben spent like 15 years in Niseko, so he's got a great understanding of the, you know, ski field needs and operations, which is a totally different thing to Kyoto.
Oh hell yeah,
no comparison whatsoever. So it's very helpful to have that experience, and he's quite knowledgeable about the Nagano area as well. And you know, we feel like that's an area that's definitely going to develop.
So to tie back into that discussion about minimum ticket entry level, what do you see in Nagano? What do you feel comfortable saying might be profitable there?
I think we're still kind of feeling our way a little bit with Nagano. The biggest issue is there's almost no supply. So right. It's a very small market there. We have one lodge that's for sale, that is like a multi-group. I think it's got 11 rooms or something, plus a house, and that's going for like 110 million at about a 7% yield, for example. But I think
I should actually I'll take this offline with you a little bit later, but I'm just about to publish a video that I did with our buddy Matt Ketchum. We've got a client who's selling a 2 onsen resorts, total of 30 rooms plus 2 standalone villas. Very cheap, very, very cheap, but it would need a lot of work. So I guess the total ticket price would probably come close to what you're talking about there.
So we've got that property on the books, and then, you know, sometimes some things pop up, but then there is quite a lot of demand and not much supply, so they're gone in a flash. You know, and we're having a look at some less well-known ski fields now that might be of interest. So places like, you know, we're Ben's in Iyama, so he's got Nozawa Onsen and Madarao, and then there's Myoko not so far. It's a couple of smaller ski fields around there, and you know, perhaps those might be of interest, and there's definitely been some buying in those areas as well. So we're trying to kind of really get a feel for the bigger picture. But
the Aussies love Madarao. Our clients have been purchasing their left, right, and center.
Right. Yeah. I thought that was the standout when I visited the other day. I thought it was the most thing. But yeah, the supply is finite there. And, you know, we're thinking, I mean, Ben's got some ideas. He thinks that actually Iyama there with the Shinkansens might become more developed there, and people might just shoot up to.
Okay.
You know, so that's something as well. And then you've probably seen the issues with staff accommodation in Niseko at the moment. Seen that, those kinds of things popping up. So that's going to happen in Nagano as well. So perhaps the staff accommodation is going to be developing more around that Iyama area, which will mean there's some interesting real estate deals to be done there as well.
Would you get into development projects? Like, if there's no existing properties, then how about buying a land parcel and turning it into a hospitality property from the ground up?
So that's certainly crossed my mind quite a bit. We're actually working on one at the moment. It's going to be residential, actually. It's a very nice piece of land on the Kamogawa, and it's not quite suited to hospitality, so that's going to be our first residential development project. Not confirmed.
So you're handling what, the brokerage and the construction, and then you're gonna run it as a residential property? That's a bit out of your, I don't want to say comfort zone, but out of what you usually do, isn't it?
That's right. It is it would be our first residential project. So we would be the local partner for a foreign investor with a lot of
Okay.
experience, a lot more experience in that kind of area. So we'd do the local work for them, and then the idea would be to sell the units on completion.
Very
So
interesting.
yeah, I'm happy to update as the project moves along. We're still kind of it's very early days there, but we're trying to go for something that's would be quite unique. So it's a good learning opportunity for us. And I was told that with our plans, it could be the best apartment in the whole city. So
So who, because the population there can't be growing, who would be your typical tenant? Is that staff housing again?
for that particular one, we're looking to price it at, I think it's the top floor is Juroku Oku apartment. So it would probably be a foreign buyer. It's on the Kamogawa, just near the Ritz-Carlton. So it's one of the most exclusive pieces of land in the city, and so we were really going for that higher end.
So holiday units.
We were planning 3 245 square meter units, and I guess that type of client wouldn't be using it all the time. But yeah, there's a few apartments nearby of similar type quality, and they move very quickly, and it's foreign buyers that are coming in, big hearing.
And then if you're I'm just sorry, this is just interesting for me personally. So if you're in charge of the project and then you're going to be selling out the units individually, that's probably lending itself to a situation where the building would be short-term stay friendly, wouldn't
I don't think it's going to be economical at that price range.
No. Okay.
No, I just don't think it's going to work. So I would imagine it would be like probably ultra high net worth for the top floor, and then maybe the bottom floor could be maybe domestic high net worth,
Okay.
or
Yeah.
sorry,
So personal use holiday units, not rentals.
that's what I'm imagining, but
Okay.
we'll see.
Yeah, keep us posted. Very interesting. All right. Well,
Yeah.
thanks for your time.
Sure. Pleasure.
Very good to speak to you, and we will be in touch with the project updates as soon as we're able. Thank you.
Cool. Always happy to chat. Thank you, Zip.
So there you have it, Chai Kanda, founder and CEO of Shiki Properties. And if you'd like to hear more from him, diving even deeper into some of these topics, we'll link to a few of his previous presentations at the Japan Real Estate Summit in this episode show notes. The man really knows what he's talking about, real professional, and a real delight to work with as well. Now, we can't let you go without telling you about MailMate, our sponsors and business partners. They offer peace of mind for your property in Japan. They'll make sure that your taxes, your utility bills are all paid on time, liaise with your management company for you, or assist with your parcel delivery while you're out of town. Get in touch with them on mailmate.jp today and mention the Japan Real Estate Podcast for 10% off your first year. And that's it from us for this episode, folks. Huge thank you for tuning in. Please do follow and subscribe to the show if this is your first time listening, and we'd love it if you could like and even share this episode with anyone you think might find interest in it. But even more importantly, we love hearing from you. So please let us know what you thought about this episode or the podcast overall in the comments section here on our social media channels. We've got a very active Facebook group and business page, both under the name Japan Real Estate on Facebook. And that's also the name and URL of our YouTube channel if you'd like to follow us there, Japan Real Estate on YouTube as well. And we'd of course appreciate your rating or review on Spotify or on the Apple Store or wherever you're tuning in from. Hope to have you with us again. Have a great rest of the day or night ahead. Yoroshiku.